Oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention. For the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
You may be seated. We have four cases in the oral submission docket. They are as follows. Insurance Company of North America versus Morris. Childs versus Hunsucker. Humble Sand and Gravel versus Martinez and Hasty Exploration versus Neal. We will hear all of these arguments before the noon recess. We will go straight through. The arguments are being recorded for the benefit of the court. If you would like a tape of the arguments, please see our clerk. Chief Justice Phillips has voluntarily recused himself from the first case, but he will not sit in INA versus Morris. As to the other cases, Chief Justice Phillips will fully participate in the deliberation of the position of those cases. He is away from the city in a family emergency. Counsel has been previously notified as to the time allotted to each. We're ready to hear the argument in the first case, Insurance Company North America versus Morris.
May it please the court, Mr. David C. Maska will present argument for the petitioners. The petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, good morning. My name is David Maska. I represent the petitioners, INA, for Wakefield Services. In a general sense, the fundamental issue in this case is whether INA, as a commercial surety, may be held legally responsible for the wrongful conduct of the promoters and the salesmen in connection with an investment solicitation, as distinguished from the surety bond that INA provided in this case. Time permitting, I'd like to address two principal reasons why the judgment against INA in this case should be reversed. First, the investors were not consumers of INA's internal surety underwriting services, and as such lacked standing under the Deceptive Trade Practices Act. Secondly, the promoters and salesmen who sold these limited partnership investment vehicles to the respondents were not in that capacity acting as INA's agents, and as such INA is not responsible for their wrongful conduct nor bound by their conduct. I'd like to address the Deceptive Trade Practices Act issue first. And I'd like to say at the outset that no other court has ever found, before the 14th court in this case, that a commercial surety has provided internal underwriting services to investors in speculative oil and gas investments such that those investors are consumers of the underwriting services the surety provided or produced for its own internal purposes. In this case, of course, the jury clearly found that there were no deceptive trade practices, acts, omissions, or misrepresentations with regard to the only good or service INA provided, its commercial surety bond, its financial guarantee in this transaction.
Would you explain for us the relationship between INA and respectively Waite, Phillips, and Colony?
Be happy to. INA is the named insurance company who issued the bond. Wakefield Services acted as INA's managing agent pursuant to an agency contract and conducted through its offices some of the due diligence and underwriting services associated with the evaluation generally of the program and specifically of the investor's creditworthiness. Phillips was an insurance broker and financial broker out of Florida that acted as a conduit between the promoters and syndicators in Tennessee and Wakefield Services in Virginia, acting as managing agent for INA. Colony was what we call a reinsurer. It is a company to whom a portion of the risk under the surety bonds was ceded after the bonds were issued. Of course, INA remains principally liable on the bonds as the company that signed the bonds.
But you do concede that Waite is your agent?
Waite was conceded at trial, and it is conceded for purposes of argument today, yes.
What were the jury findings concerning Waite with regard to deceptive acts?
There were no separate findings as to Waite or INA. They were submitted collectively. And in response to question 12, the jurors clearly found as follows. That INA and its agents, if any, did not cause any misunderstanding among the investors regarding the source, sponsorship, approval, or certification of the surety bonds, that INA and its agents did not misrepresent the terms, use, benefits, or obligations associated with those surety bonds, that INA did not fail to disclose any information to the investors to induce the transactions, that INA did not cause any confusion in the investors as to its affiliation, if any, with the promoter and the salesman with regard to the transactions, and that INA did not otherwise misrepresent its status in connection with this transaction.
Do I recall now that Jim Brown that INA had some unconscionable action?
That is the only basis for the DGPA finding this case.
And that stands alone aside from the answer to question 12?
It was part of question 12. There were several subparts, and what I've generally summarized were 8 of the 9 subparts, and the 9th subpart was, do you find that INA engaged in unconscionable conduct? And the answer to that question is yes. It was otherwise no. And the only way that unconscionable conduct under the DTPA can form a basis of responsibility here, getting back to the point I was making, is you have to be a consumer. And in this case, the jury found no misrepresentations, no deceptive laundry list acts. They only found unconscionable conduct. The Court of Appeals correctly concluded that the purchase of a surety bond, even if intertwined with an investment, is not the purchase of a good, because you're buying either an intangible or you're buying a security, neither of which are recognized as goods. But the Court of Appeals, and what I'd like to characterize as a real stretch, said, nevertheless, the investors purchased INA's internal underwriting services, its own due diligence, INA's investigation of generally these programs for its own benefit, and specifically the creditworthiness of these investors. That was the consumer status that the Court of Appeals found in this case. And that holding is unsupported by any precedent, and it's fundamentally flawed because INA's internal underwriting services was not an important objective of this transaction. The objective of the transaction from the investor's standpoint was to acquire an investment, a speculative oil and gas limited partnership investment. Nor did the provision of, as the Court of Appeals characterized it, INA's internal underwriting services, form the basis of the investor's complaints. What they complained about in this case was a bad investment, inducement into a bad investment based upon investor fraud in connection with the investment solicitation. This Court of Appeals holding opens the door for the DPPA to be used as a litigation tool in a whole host of business enterprises who engage in underwriting activities. Let me give you an example. We're reading the paper here over the television every day. Auto dealerships that promote the ability to provide a package deal. I'll sell you the car and I'll give you prearranged financing at a favorable below market rate. And I've got this credible lender, GMAC, that's got a program that I can provide to you. If this holding stands, anyone who buys a car that turns out to be a lender, coupled with that kind of lending program that's prearranged through the auto dealership, has standing to claim that the lender's internal due diligence concerning the dealership or that person's creditworthiness is somehow a service that they acquired in addition to the automobile, which was the objective of their transaction, and gives them consumer status. That's what this holding says, in essence. Here, of course, the principal objective of the transaction, as I described, is the acquisition of an investment. It was not the acquisition of underwriting services performed by a commercial surety. In addition, those underwriting services, as a host of cases have held, one in particular on this very transaction, the Dealey case out of the Fifth Circuit, they have all held that the acts of the surety in conducting its own due diligence are conducted solely for the surety's benefit. And they are not intended to, nor do they provide a service or a benefit to investors. What the investors bought was the surety's obligation to bond and to cover their defaults on the promissory notes. They have the right to expect the surety to honor that contract, and in this case, as the jury found, the surety did in fact honor its contract. The Court of Appeals analogized the underwriting to cases which hold that services may include investment and counseling. And they said these are investment and counseling services that the surety somehow provided to these investors. In this case, none of the Court of Appeals' citations to Brazell, Rittenhour, or Nottingham are on point for a lot of reasons, and I'll summarize four of them. INA did not provide any investment advice to these investors, nor did it purport to do so. In fact, it specifically disavowed that in the documents made available to these investors, although many of them chose not to read them. There was no premium paid above the cost of the bond for this investment advice and counseling that the Court of Appeals characterized. There was no promise made to these investors by the surety other than the promises and obligations undertaken in the bond. And there was no separate contract entered into for services other than the services reflected by the bond document.
But and there was a separate contract of indemnity between INA and investors.
Yes, it was. And that contract was essentially an obligation in the event that INA was obligated to honor the bond if an investor defaulted, that the investor then undertook an obligation to indemnify INA for its costs and expenses. That contract nowhere addresses investment advice or counsel. The conclusion to be reached here is that there's no claim under the bond. The jury found that. There is no consumer status with regard to INA's internal underwriting services for the reason that those were conducted solely for INA's benefit, and they do not constitute investment or counsel advice. As such, these investors lack standing as consumers under the DPPA, and the DPPA findings and judgment must be reversed. I'd like to turn briefly to the agency issue. The issue here is twofold. Is there the existence of an agency relationship, and if so, what is the scope of that relationship?
And there could be, depending on the evidence.
Depending on the evidence, under a common law parent agency or a statutory agency theory, there could be some evidence of an agency relationship. We need to deal with the scope of that agency relationship. We have taken really two points here. There's no evidence of a common law apparent agent relationship. And with regard to the statutory agency under 2102 of the insurance code, those duties and obligations are limited to the ability to deal with, explain, and concern your agency relationship with the insurance product. And in this case, again, getting back to the jury findings, there was no finding of any problem with regard to the insurance product. The Court of Appeals really, in a commingling of these common law and statutory concepts, and I'm paraphrasing, concluded that the agent, the investment salesmen were INA's agents because they were statutory agents acting with implied or apparent authority within the scope of that authority to sell the investments and the bonds. And that's where the problem lies in this case. While they may have been a statutory agent to sell the bonds, there was no problem with the bonds. They were not a statutory agent to sell the investment. And it was plainly wrong, that decision, because the plain language of 2102 says you are a statutory agent as to the insurance product. And this court, of course, in Celtic Life said the ability or the authority to explain a policy doesn't give you the authority to go beyond the policy. And logically, it doesn't give one the authority to become a statutory agent with respect to an investment product as opposed to the insurance product. Now, with regard to the question of common law apparent agency as to the investment product in this case, the investors had to demonstrate that they had a reasonable belief based upon INA's conduct and that that belief was justified and that their reliance was justified based upon INA's representations of its agent's authority. In this case, the investors admitted as follows. None of the salesmen told them that they were acting for or on behalf of INA. The investors simply believed that subjectively, and they believed it because the investors touted INA's involvement as a commercial surety providing the surety bonds. That's basically what the investors said. Now, let's get back to my automobile example. If I, as a dealer, sell a car, and I tout the fact that GMAC is going to provide below-market financing, and what a great deal this is, am I acting as GMAC's agent with regard to representations concerning whether this car is new or used, whether it has certain attributes that it may or may not have? Of course not. Logically, I'm not. In this case, we have the regulatory framework, in addition, that draws a distinction between the agency authority as to the insurance product and the authority as to the investment vehicle. Moreover, the conduct of INA did not clothe these salesmen with agency authority with regard to the investment. Cases have directly dealt with these issues. The Dealey case in particular said that the act of putting someone in the position of taking and transmitting applications, accepting bond premiums in connection with these investment solicitations is merely a clerical function, daily grist of the mill, does not give rise to any agency relationship. The Deloach Court, dealing with identical investment solicitation transactions, wrote at length about how the surety's involvement in these kinds of programs, its underwriting activities, its actions associated with the program, its placing of the salesman in a position to take the bond applications, none of that gives rise to an assumption of an apparent agency relationship. And moreover, the investors in this case were not misled. The agency relationship was expressly disclaimed, both in the private placement memorandum, which was given to them at the time of the solicitation, and in the letters they signed thereafter. And for those reasons, they were not acting as agents.
As to your last comment, let me ask you a question. If the facts are as you say that they are, why then the estoppel letter later on after the fact?
Well, the estoppel letter was not later on after the fact. Let me explain that if I could, Your Honor. There was an estoppel letter, a representation letter, submitted to these investors when they signed the first package of documents. There was a second letter submitted with a new bond document that had been requested by the lender to include some provisions of waiver of defenses as to the lender. Then with regard to Overlord 4, that was Overlord 3, there were two letters requested. Overlord 4, the estoppel letter, as you characterized it, was part of the initial package. There never was a second package.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
May it please the court. Mr. Andrew R. Harbin will present arguments and responses.
May it please the court, if I may address Justice Gonzalez's last question. There is nothing in the record in this case to show that the investors signed an estoppel letter when they paid their money, when they subscribed to these agreements. Overlord 3. The only evidence in this case, and there was nothing ever produced in this case to suggest that an estoppel letter was provided to these investors before they subscribed to Overlord 3. The evidence is, you can look all through the record, that the estoppel letter of Overlord 3 was provided by the unlicensed salesman sanctioned by Wade Hill and INA to the investors after they had already paid their money. Mrs. Rebecca Redd, a retired public school teacher in the state, bought one unit of Overlord 3, two units of Overlord 4, and she was told by the salesman that unless she signed the letter as well as the six-page bond, she would lose her $5,000 down payment and jeopardize the partnership. Mr. Lowe and Mr. Morris were told that they have to sign the documents or the deal would not go through.
Was that Mr. Ace or Mr. Gunnels that made those statements to Ms. Redd?
Yes, sir.
So, whether they were true or not depends on whether those two were agents of the INA, is that right?
Yes, sir.
And that's the bottom line issue, is
that's
how good. Those two were agents of INA, and how do you say that they were?
Yes, sir. Under the Texas Insurance Code, the law requires
common law apparent agency argument first, if you will.
Under the apparent agency argument, INA, through Wakefield Services, which was the managing agent of INA, allowed the surety bond to be sold with the private placement memorandum, with the package. And the reason for that was they had to get 80% of the investors to subscribe in the deal. And they allowed...
But would they have had to get 80% without, with or without the bond, or was that the INA requirement?
That was an underwriting requirement of Wakefield Services.
And I don't want to interrupt from what you're saying to him, and I want to ask you a question, and then you would go back to answering his, but isn't it common, in fact, almost always you're going to have a surety bond in this type of situation? And then the second part, isn't it true that the entity issuing the surety bond is going to require certain percentages like the 80% rule?
Well, actually, at the time, I don't know if it was common. We had a witness, Bruno Trampoli, who was the CEO of Commonwealth, who testified that actually he developed the concept of surety bond financing. And the reason why he developed it was in order to get an A-plus 15 rated company, because the companies that he was dealing with, Wayhill and Colony, were unrated, unregistered, small-time companies out of Virginia. They were not registered here in Texas. They needed the reputation and credibility of a company like INA, a large reputable company, to sell the programs.
All right. So was he, who was the, if I recall, the head of the Overlord 3 and 4 group that did the deal with INA for that purpose, is that correct?
That's correct, to market the programs.
So their dealings were between he and INA, and not the investors in INA.
Well, the investors dealt through the PPM. The PPM mentioned
well,
INA.
Is it correct that the head of the Overlord partnership, who was selling, was dealt with INA?
That's correct.
The bond part of the package.
Through Wayhill versus the Board.
The investors dealt with Mr. Gunn.
That's correct.
Who were employees of the Overlord group.
That's correct.
Are you saying that you cannot structure this transaction that involves a minimal amount of bonding for the deal to go through and selling of the two at the same time? There's no way to structure that without making whoever is selling them the bonding company's agent. Well, Judge Baker asked you why, under the common law, were they the agent, and you said because the underwriting requirement was 80% and because the bonds were sold with the investment.
And because INA, through Wayfield Services, allowed these salesmen to represent the fact that INA had investigated the principals, had backed the program, and had found the program to be sound. It was a marketing tool that Wayfield Services allowed these salesmen to use. And only after the fact, in the bait and switch, did they present an estoppel letter to have the investor sign. If the court were to hold the estoppel letter, for instance, precluded agency in the case, it would allow a salesman in any kind of transaction, take the car transaction Mr. Matthew presented, to say anything they want to produce the sale, take the money, and then send a disclaimer or have the purchaser sign the disclaimer after the purchase. The court...
Well, let me ask you this. If a bonding company or an insurance company decides it's going to insure a transaction, a lending transaction, that's all this is. It's just, they're just the lender that's going to fund this transaction.
I would disagree with that.
Commonwealth could not have obtained the money to do this deal without having a surety backing up the loan.
That's correct. I would disagree with the statement. They're just a lender. Go ahead.
Well, I'm not talking about INA. I'm talking about the lender. The big person with the money that's going to put this transaction in the ground won't do it unless there's a bonding company that essentially insures those loans.
In this situation.
Okay. Wouldn't, in any circumstance where that existed, wouldn't the people selling this to the individual investors implicitly, if not expressly, be representing that there's an insurance company that's behind, that is insuring this loan, and by golly, they wouldn't be doing this without their underwriters looking at it and thinking it's a good deal? I mean, wouldn't that even if you just announced there was an insurance company behind
it? Yes, Your Honor, but the fact that INA and Wakefield Services allow the salesman to do that, and they don't have a licensed insurance agent present the estoppel letter, present the bond, explain the consequences of that, and explain that the fact INA has not investigated the quality of the program or the background of the promoter.
So,
that should have been done. And the failure to do that.
Here, so the problem here is that there's apparent authority because INA didn't prohibit the Commonwealth from telling people that INA was insuring the loan in this transaction.
They didn't do that. They didn't have a licensed agent on the grounds required by Texas law to sell the insurance product, but, to explain the product.
But wouldn't they then be in violation of the private placement memorandum by failing to disclose their involvement in the transaction? I mean, how is Commonwealth complying with what it's supposed to do if it cannot disclose INA's involvement in the transaction?
Oh, Commonwealth can disclose it. But my position with regard to the participation in fraud is that Wakehill Services control most of the terms of the program and had the right to change the PPM, had the right to rewrite portions of the PPM,
so
had the right to set the number of wells.
Wasn't that as between them and the person offering the investment as opposed to between them and the investors?
I think it doesn't matter because they're joint participants in the fraud.
Well, what if the lenders had those requirements? What if the lenders said, we won't finance unless you change the structure of the deal? Would that make the lender liable to the investor?
Well, I think the lender as well as the surety would have the right to review the PPM. But if the lender as well as the surety control the terms of the program?
The lender said, I will not fund under this structure. You change the structure, and then I'll fund.
And if the lender reviewed the private placement memorandum and had the right to write portions of it, had the right to discover the background of the principals and discover the fact that John Met had served time in Tennessee in prison for this scheme, discovered that fact, and failed to require disclosure of it in the PPM, I could be here before you saying that the lender was an aider and abettor as well, because of the absolute control that Wakefield Services had in this particular program. There's not a case, none of the cases cited by Mr. Matthew in regard to aiding and abetting deal with companies or surety that fail to follow the insurance code, to have licensed agents on the ground explaining the complicated product.
Well, you're assuming that a surety bond is an insurance product, aren't you?
Absolutely. As it's stated in the insurance code under 2701, sureties, I'm aware of the great municipal case, but under 2107, 2109, sureties are expressly included in the statute.
Your argument seems to come close to saying that if you lend money to a crook, you're liable for what he does.
It
seems to go too far.
Your Honor, under the facts of the case, they're bad facts. And let me show you just one piece of evidence. Wakefield Services discovered that John Met had been enjoined 4 years earlier for an SEC violation. None of us in this courtroom would have purchased this security at all had we known of that, had it been disclosed. The evidence is that Lon Burgess, who worked for Gordon Phillips, who's a marketing agent for INA, discovered that, and in fact, for a short time, said we're not going to bond the deal. But because Wakefield Services engaged in a subterfuge and set up a paper trail to protect themselves, for this very day in court, here we are in Austin, arguing for this very day, and one of the pieces of evidence we have was a report with the underwriting procedures that said all reports received from Bank Capital, who is the due diligence investigator, are positive reports. If the due diligence review will provide a negative recommendation, changes in the business proposal, the PPM offering must be amended. If the recommendations for change are not met, then the due diligence report for the surety is discontinued and no report is issued, meaning that the surety will never have, in any case, even if the money disappears, like what happened to Rebecca Redd, will never have a negative due diligence report. It will always be positive. So when the fateful day comes, when the fraud is discovered, they can stand up before the court and they can say, we relied upon the due diligence report. We relied upon the attorney's opinion letter. The attorney's opinion letters and the due diligence reports were received by Wakefield Services after the programs were already out on the street and after Mr. Morris here subscribed in Overlord 4. What kind of reliance is that?
Mr. Harris, let me ask you a question, picking up your argument that the investors here have somehow been misled.
Yes, sir.
The PPM, at least Overlord 3, says, no dealer, salesman, or any other person has been authorized to give any information or to make any representations on behalf of the partnership or general partners related to this offering other than set forth this offering memorandum. The unit involves a high degree of risk, and the availability of any cash returns from this investment is speculative. Further goes on to say, a limited partner should understand that it is extremely difficult to predict returns from the oil and gas drilling program, and it is possible that no wells drilled will produce any oil and gas or any revenues. And if you look at the drilling program, the prior activities, and you analyze that, it has a very, very poor return. In light of all of that, where the investor knows that they're getting into a speculative venture, where is the fraud? Where is the misrepresentation?
First of all, with regard to the high-risk speculative disclosure on the front page of the PPM, that's virtually in every limited partnership that's formed.
Are they bound by those terms?
I would say not, because there are other provisions in the offering memorandum that say that the drilling, particularly in this case, let me get you another exhibit. In the surety section, this is the section that admittedly the surety has the right to monitor. Diversified programs are best adapted to a surety bond feature. Risks are less in a program involving multiple wells and several or a number of prospects than a program which drills only a single well. A surety bond program should engage primarily in low-risk developmental drilling. Mr. Glass.
So you said that negates the terms of the PPM?
Well, it goes directly to the kind of program that's being drilled. It's more specific than the general boilerplate that you just read. When you look at the geology, when you look at the prospects in the back of the PPM that Mr. Glass read, when he invested, he went to the prospects and he read the conclusions about the prospect. And the last prospect, for instance, on Overlord 4 says, this prospect offers an excellent chance for a low-risk drilling venture. That, coupled with the fact that the salesmen, sanctioned by Wade Hill, were counting these things not as just low-risk, but on past programs. The past programs have returned 2 or 3 to 1 the dollar, when in fact they've only returned 10 cents. And I'll address your point on that as well.
Is there any evidence that INA knew that these salespeople were making those statements? Or is it correct that when we're talking about common law parent agency, we look to the conduct of the principal, not the conduct of the alleged agent?
That's correct.
What conduct is there in the record, if any, that show INA permitted, authorized, or otherwise, said you can tell them those kinds of things?
Well, simply because Wakefield and INA allowed the salesmen, who were the security sales, who were
unlicensed,
to sell the product. They needed to sell, they needed to make those kinds of representations in order to sell the product at the 80% surety financing.
But what product?
The investment. Which
the investment. Now, INA was investing in this. They were participants in the drilling. No, sir. Tell me, what did INA do in this case?
INA was actually paid by Wakefield Services 25 cents of the premium to lend the name and assume only 25% of the risk.
But at assume risk of what?
Of the
that
risk.
That the investors would
the risk
not
of default
pay
on the loans.
That the investors would not pay their $20,000 unit price.
That's correct.
That INA was taking the risk that the investors, not Commonwealth, but that the investors would not pay their $20,000 unit price.
Correct.
That was the risk they would take. So the product that was being sold was a unit and an investment at $20,000 a piece to these investors, and that's the product being sold.
As well as the surety bond. It's an integrated product.
And the investors bought that but paid just a portion of the price
And when they learned of the fraud, they refused to pay.
And they refused to pay. And yes, so INA did what the investors asked INA to do, which is to pay off their debt to the lender.
Well, that's correct. You're forced to. But I make this note, too. INA did that with notice of the fraud in the first instance because they knew they met the injunction. And two, they did that and paid the lender with notice of fraud claims. And that's in the record as well. They had to make a choice. And the choice they made was to fight, not to fight with the lender, but to fight to try to pick off every one of these small investors, 3,000 of them, with the hope that they would never discover the fraud, with the hope that they would never discover evidence like this, where they set up a subterfuge and create bogus due diligence reports.
I don't understand it. INA paid off that lender, and now they're trying to get their money back from these investors. And you're saying, well, they shouldn't get the money back because they were participants.
They were aiders and abettors.
They would pay 100% back to the lender.
Yes, sir.
Knowing that this was a fraudulent transaction.
Yes, sir.
So they were going to be on the hook
anymore
for all this money. Why would a bonding company say we're going to take on 100% risk for all these fraudulent people out there?
Because the and this is in the record as well, the recapture penalties under the IRS code make it awfully difficult for investors to fight this thing. And I think it was Mr. Fraser and Mr. Holberg from Wakefield admitted that they thought the default rate on the loans would be very minimal because of the recapture penalties. So they took the chance to pay off the lender and to fight the investors, knowing that the investors, hoping the investors wouldn't discover this problem.
Is it correct, because I recall that Mrs. Redd was the only person who paid the entire amount and all the other investors, at least in this litigation, paid only the $5,000 down payment?
Paid $5,000 plus a one installment of $1,666.
And how? What was the interval of the payment on the note?
I'm sorry?
What was the interval of the payments on the note?
I think yearly.
So they made the first payment up front, the installment up front.
That's correct.
And then didn't pay the second one.
The money
and you said because they learned of the fraud.
That's correct.
By Ace and Gunn.
And nobody. Not just by them, but by Wakefield Services. Mr. Phillips and Newman met the time.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Unless there are additional questions, I'll be very brief.
Let me ask a question. I'm sorry. It seems to me that Mr. Harbin is essentially arguing that INA, by its conduct, took control of this investment. And it seems to me it would be possible that the bonding company, if it exercised so much control of the investment, that it probably would be the principal for these agents who are out misrepresenting the nature of this investment. Where would you draw the line between where the bonding company steps over the line and becomes the principal in the investment scheme as merely as opposed to just simply someone who's in basically insuring the loan on this transaction?
Well, I think it didn't happen in this case, but I think the insurance company, and I'm not aware of it happening, for instance, in similar cases that have handled these kinds of transactions. The bonding company, I think, would have to step over the line by controlling the manner and method in which these investors are solicited, by controlling the way in which they're presented to the investors, by directing the supposed agents in those activities, by participating directly in the investment solicitation activities. And in this case, frankly, the bonding company was far removed, not only mileage-wise in terms of across the country, but involvement-wise from any solicitation of this investment activities. The bonding company, as Justice Gonzales pointed out, is described in private placement memorandum. Its relationship to the transaction is described in the private placement memorandum. The disclaimer of any agency relationship is described in the private placement memorandum. And in this case, this bonding company did what every case that has considered these kinds of transactions says is ordinary, prudent internal underwriting activities. Because obviously,
A bonding company that takes a $42,000 premium to assume $800,000 in risk associated with defaulted loans is going to want to do some internal due diligence to make a determination whether they want to assume that kind of risk. I think that's an important factor here when we talk about subterfuges and frauds and integrated offering. What the insurance company was doing here was being paid a premium of $42,000 to assume $800,000 of risk. And in this case, that's what this company did. And when that risk came to pass and these investors defaulted, the insurance company stepped up to the bar, paid the money on behalf of these investors, and assumed the obligations that they had failed to do in connection with those
questions. But they did two other things. They got an indemnification agreement from each investor.
They did indeed.
They got the balance of the notes that they paid off.
They did indeed, in hopes that they might recoup some or all of the loss of the risk in this case.
So they got protection on both sides of the
case. No question about it. And that is proof insurance surety practice. When I take out a supersedious bond or appeal a case, the bonding company looks to the principal in the event the bonding company is called to honor the judgment, right? And that's proven underwriting practice. There's nothing nefarious.
I'm a little confused. Was each investor a principal on a surety bond?
Absolutely. Each investor was a principal on each of the surety bonds. And with regard, I want to make one other factual point. With regard to the first installment payment, the evidence in this case is that was paid out of the program. Proceeds from the program, I don't know where they came from. We had no evidence in this case as to why these programs failed to begin with. But each investor put $5,000 down, signed a promissory note for $15,000. A year later, the program paid one of those installments. When apparently these programs went south, the investor said, I'm not paying any more money. You guys, you investor salesmen, you told me I wouldn't have to ever pay on these notes because the program would pay it. And now look, it's failed and I've got to pay and I'm not going to do it. INA stepped up and said, we're obligated to pay the lender, and they did.
Yes, but then you want to go after the investor to keep your losses.
Absolutely.
Well, see, the way I'm looking at this too simply here, but
yes.
Commonwealth needed a cover, needed a front, needed a big name company, so they got INA to give it the aura of respectability and credibility with these investors. INA is in the business of insuring risk, taking risks.
Yes.
But you're saying, well, we're in that business, but we're covered either way, because if the investors don't pay, the investors have to pay us. So we're in a win-win situation. So INA, we can turn loose these agents that will cross the line and misrepresent and induce investors because you're in a win-win situation. And then now you come up here and say, oh, but we didn't even have to tell them we were dealing with crooks. We didn't have to tell them about the injunction and the unregulated securities because we had no duty and because we're covered either way. Is that the posture of the case here?
I understand.
What am I missing? What am I missing?
May I respond to both?
All right.
First of all, INA was not the only insurance company in the industry doing these kinds of programs.
So because everybody's doing it, it's okay?
No, I'm not saying everybody's doing it, it's okay. I'm saying Commonwealth could very well have found a number of other people to do this. It isn't INA standing alone that acts as the surety in these kinds of programs. But yes, INA is providing, not insurance, really. They are providing a credit enhancement. They're providing the ability for these lenders to make a tax-leveraged investment.
Which right, is so they want their salesmen to sell us and lure and induce as many investors because they can collect all these premiums.
If investors...
And they're not at risk.
Of course they're at risk.
How are they at risk?
They assume the obligation in the first instance to pay the lender. Then they have the risk of trying to recover from individual investors across the country, which is no easy proposition. And there is a risk associated with defaults. If investors are going to default on note payments, they're likewise going to default on indemnification obligations. And the costs and risk associated with that is a risk that this insurance company took on for the $42,000 it got paid. And it provided not an insurance product, but a credit enhancement vehicle. It's not really in the insurance business. It's in the credit enhancement business in this connection. I hope I've answered.
Is the $42,000 all that it would ever have made, or would it have made more money as this?
All of these is a single premium for the issuance of the bond.
All right. That concludes the presentation. This case will be in total sense.